Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. We are conducting an exclusive interview with Nova Spivak, celebrated, world-renowned, pioneering global technology visionary, innovator, strategist, entrepreneur, and investor. Nova, you have just really an incredible history of notable historical distinction, significant outstanding contributions in just so many fields, and as a globally top-ranking authority in technology, innovation, strategy, entrepreneurship, and investments. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Nova, as I mentioned, you are really an historical figure, and you're continuing to make significant contributions to the world. Can you highlight what you consider to be your top four contributions and their lasting historical significance?
Well, I think one of the first examples would be the early days of the World Wide Web. In 1993 and 94, I helped to start one of the first web companies in the world. It was called EarthWeb. So that was the first, and really helped there to pioneer the early days of the internet and the web, particularly understanding business models and how to do online commerce in particular. Secondly, through that, then helped to really launch and evangelize Java technology, working on a number of projects with Sun Microsystems. One was called Gamelon, which was the leading open site about Java for developers, and started the Worldwide Java Developers Alliance, so really helped to bring that new model of software to the world. And then in the 1990s, late 90s, early 2000s, worked on the early days of the semantic web, pioneering the concept of smart data and helping to evangelize that through a site called Twine.com. And more recently, what I'm doing now is a new model for innovation, which I think of as like a production studio, like a film studio, but for creating technology ventures. So I call it a venture production studio. And right now I have seven different new startup ventures working on the emerging technology frontiers, including the next generation of the real-time web. I'm also working on wireless power and many other really interesting projects.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned your work with Java early on and at Sun. Did you also work with Eric Schmidt at that time?
Well, I certainly knew Eric, and we did interact at the time. He was CTO over there, and so we had you know, a lot of conversations and meetings, and coordinated very closely with his people.
Now, can you profile, and you mentioned this already in terms of some of your venture work, your current and future areas of focus and why they resonate with you?
Well, you know, I think there have been some themes in my work. You know, one of the big themes has been trying to use massive amounts of data to create smarter applications and services. So really data mining and making sense of trends and patterns in large amounts of data to do personalization, targeting, or personal assistance. I worked on a project with SRI and DARPA in the United States, which is the Defense Department, their advanced innovation group, on an intelligent assistant called Kalo, for example, which mined a lot of data from your email and other work that you did to try to assist you. So this theme has been in my work consistently, and it continues today with work we're doing in a project called Bottlenose, where we're mining Twitter and the social web to develop personalization to help users make more sense of what's going on in the real-time stream to filter information for them. So that's a big theme. Another theme has been entrepreneurial endeavors and really helping to start ventures and figuring out ways to get early stage ideas to market inexpensively and quickly. And I think, you know, this new work that I'm doing now with the Venture Production Studio really takes that to the next level. You know, previously I would work on one company at a time, and now I have seven that I'm working on. So that's kind of interesting. And that theme, I think, you know, will continue as I develop this idea further. In the future, areas that I'm interested in, you know, continue this trend, but really focus a lot on intelligent assistance. I really believe that that's going to be a very big and important piece of our lives in the future, is that we will have these sort of automated intelligent assistants in different areas, whether we're driving or walking down the street or, you know, seeking advice about a medical issue or or being a tourist, any of these scenarios, there's lots of opportunities there. Another area is augmented reality, where I think, in partnership with these intelligent assistants, we'll be annotating and extending our experience of the physical world as we move around. And then something I'm quite interested in and I think is very important is new energy technologies, new ways of generating energy, new ways of distributing energy that can free us from fossil fuels and also can make existing use of energy far more efficient. And so there, I think that's necessary for the next generation of technology. And one of the reasons I'm working on wireless power is because I think mobility is so important, and we've got to find a way to give power to mobile devices without wires and without the limitations of today's batteries.
Wow, that's really an amazing array of projects that you're working on, and ventures and themes. And I guess then from your current role, there must be some top challenges then and top opportunities within all of these different ventures that you're working on.
Yeah, I think the challenges when you're doing this kind of work, are getting funding, of course. So, when you're working with early stage projects that use a lot of innovation, it takes a very particular kind of investor with forward vision, and finding people like that who understand what you're doing and are interested in taking the kind of risks that we take for the chance that there might be a big breakthrough. That's one thing. So finding those investors is always a challenge, although we've been lucky to find a lot of them. I think the next big challenge is talent, is attracting entrepreneurs to be involved in these companies, in some cases to lead these companies as the CEO, in other cases to be on the team. That's, of course, very important to all of my projects. And so my model has really been my production studio starts and incubates the companies and fills a number of those key management roles in the beginning. And then we gradually find, the right people, and we put them into the key roles over time. And then the company eventually leaves the nest and is able to go out on its own. And so, in several of these companies now, we have terrific CEOs who, have tremendous industry backgrounds in their respective fields. And so the model's working. But, it's very important, I think, as this grows, to create a system where we're constantly meeting and recruiting really interesting talent and where we're building relationships with a network of funding partners.
What kinds of lessons shaped your life and you think would be useful to the audience?
Well, in thinking about that question, I think there are four big lessons that, kind of jump out. One is growing up with my grandfather, Peter Drucker, who was a well-known management theorist. He was a huge influence on me as a child, and certainly, through my college years. He passed away not too long ago, and so I was fortunate to know him even as an adult. But he had a huge influence on how I look at problems, how I solve problems, how I think about the world, my understanding of systems, and I think also on a personal level, he gave me a lot of guidance for my own career and direction. So I had the benefit of having him as my sort of personal consultant at times, which I think was a rare privilege, really. So he was a huge influence, and I could speak at length, really, about that. Another big life-changing event for me was in 1992. I attended the International Space University, which was an international program to train business and technical leaders in the space industry. And that took place when I attended it. It took place in Japan for a summer. It was a graduate program. After that, however, what was kind of most important for me was that I took the rest of the year and just traveled alone through Asia. So I spent a year really, a student, and I spent a year just traveling through Asia on my own, just exploring and going wherever I wanted to go, and ended up primarily in Nepal and India, where I had just amazing adventures and experiences that really changed my life in a lot of different ways. When I came back from that trip, that's when I started EarthWeb. And so that was another huge experience for me. That was my first venture that I had co-founded. Previously, I had worked in ventures, but that was the first one I had started. And it, was an amazing experience because we happened to be right there at the beginning of the web and, managed to go all the way through an IPO. So it was a very exciting and I think formative experience for me as an entrepreneur. And more recently, a very big experience was the death of my father, which just happened a few months ago. And, was also an incredible learning experience, very, very, very big experience. As anybody knows, anybody who's lost a parent knows, it changes your life in so many ways. And it was something I'm still learning from.
Now, can you make your predictions of the future, their implications, and how we can best prepare?
Yeah, sure. I think, I think what I'm thinking about right now is really, I'm thinking about on a technology front, how life is going to change if some of the trends I'm seeing continue. In particular, one theme that I'm thinking about a lot is what happens as we augment reality and if that trend continues. Now, right now, very few people have even experienced what I'm talking about. But if you have a smartphone, like an iPhone, for example, you may be able to try this out. There are applications which will give you augmented reality. They will show you on your video camera information about the things that you're looking at. So if you take your camera and you look at a building, it'll tell you the name of the building, for example. Or if you're walking around, it will give you the names of streets as you look at them. Well, that can go a lot further. You can see the names of people as you talk to them, for example. You can look at products and get information about those products when you're shopping in a store. There's a lot of different possibilities with this. What's interesting is, if it goes further, what happens? Now, what do I mean? Well, imagine in the future that this pervades everything in our lives, because whether we're using a phone or it's just consumer devices that have little displays on them or can talk to you, or even possibly wearing eyeglasses or contact lenses that have little displays embedded into them, or even brain-mind interfaces where we can actually have direct connections to our brain where we can get information. However this happens, eventually it will. We will be able to get information about everything that we're looking at, everything we're doing. But what's most important, and I think a challenging question that comes out from all of this, is there will come a point when we have so much information about any decision that we're going to make, and information about what other people have done in the same situation, or what decisions worked better or didn't work, that as we do things, as we make decisions, we'll have so much information influencing that decision that the decision won't really even be our decision anymore. There will come a point where the question will be, who's actually making the decision? Is it you, or is it the collective global mind of all this software and data and machines that are all connected and giving you advice at the moment that you do anything? You know, gradually, as we get this kind of advice from the machine, we trust it, we start to take that advice, and then when that happens, the question is, who's actually the doer? Who is making the decision? Who is there free will? Is it now all of humanity or the global mind making the decision? Is it you, the individual, making the decision? What is an individual at that point? So I think we're going to get to this place not too long in the future, maybe 50 years, maybe less, where the question of what an individual is and what free will be something that becomes a very real question for all of us.
How does that tie in with this concept of a singularity, I guess Kurzweil's concept of a singularity, or does it?
I think it's actually very related. Kurzweil's concept of the singularity is that there'll be a point in time where computing power will exceed our ability to understand what's going on. And so basically we won't be able to know what happens after that point, because computers will be able to invent things that we can't imagine. They'll be able to do things that we can't understand. So basically, we can't see past that moment when computers get that powerful. I think this is a similar concept. You could think of it, he's talking about a technological singularity, and I suppose I'm talking about a psychological or spiritual singularity. The question, when these computer systems do get that powerful and they begin to give us advice and augment everything that we do, what happens to us? We won't be able to understand ourselves either, because so much of what we do will actually be dependent on information and advice that we're getting from computers.
That's really fascinating. I can see the implications, and it's good to get this into the broader conversation as you're doing. Now, the next series of questions actually come from Alex Lin, who's the founder and CEO of China Value. And so I'm going to be quoting him through these next series of questions. So the first question from Alex is, he says, thank you for accepting this interview with China Value. Your contributions in the semantic web and global brain will change the world. Please explain your ideas around the concept of the global brain, a term coined by Howard Bloom, and can you quickly profile and then comment on critical ideas in this field from a few others that you feel are noteworthy?
Well, thanks. Yes, I think the global brain is a really important idea, and it's been around actually for a lot longer than most people would think. Probably one of the earliest references to it started with H.G. Wells, who was a noted science fiction author. And he had an idea which he called a kind of world encyclopedia. He predicted that one day in the future there would be a global encyclopedia that everybody would have equal access to. Well, of course, today we have that. It's the web. And even within it, there are things like the Wikipedia, which literally are global encyclopedias. But his concept was that that world encyclopedia would be the beginning of a kind of global shared memory. So, you know, certainly a brain, a global brain, does have to have a shared memory. So I think we have that today. Teilhard de Chardin was a French priest, and he wrote a number of books that were quite important about this concept of the noosphere and also this point, this notion of the omega point. He basically believed that you know, there was this realm of ideas, the noosphere, this kind of environment of ideas and intelligence, and that we were heading towards a point in time where the whole universe would wake up and become conscious and aware. Again, another important theme that many people thinking about the global brain learned from, although, you know, Teilhard de Chardin took it to a kind of spiritual point, went into that direction, I think the general takeaway that most people got from that was really this idea that the planet could wake up. And you've heard of also, of course, things like the Gaia hypothesis and how some people have taken that literally, that, you know, the planet might have a soul or might wake up. Well, in the case of the global brain, that's a theme where we think about, is it possible for the mind of humanity, the collective mind of humanity, to wake up or to think? And in many science fiction movies, for example, The Terminator, we've seen very negative portrayals of what that might be like if the mind of the network woke up and then decided it didn't want humans around, for example. But a more positive view of that was presented by somebody named Gregory Stock, who wrote a terrific book called Meta Man. And in that book, he talked about how there are many systems today, economic systems, medical systems, agricultural systems, manufacturing systems around the world that really cannot function without the rest of the global infrastructure supporting them. For example, today, you can't run an economy in isolation. Every economy is tied to every other economy, and you see these ripple effects moving around the world. You can't separate or isolate anymore. Similarly, even a farm today, a modern day farm, it's very difficult for that farm to function without a lot of supplies and interaction with the external world. It's not an isolated farm anymore. Also, you know, a modern day hospital certainly can't function on its own. They need, you know, of course, electricity, but also supplies, expertise from specialists, interactions with laboratories. It's no longer a central system. It's become a distributed medical service. So you can look at just about anything today and find that it's connected to everything else. And so MetaMan was a book that really explored that in great detail and in a very technical kind of economic way. Francis Halen, another very important researcher, spent many years working on a big project online called the Principia Cybernetica, which is basically a set of algorithms and essays about collective intelligence and how to help large collective intelligences learn on the web. Of course, my friend Howard Bloom, who you mentioned, has written a number of wonderful books about collective intelligence and the global brain. And his primary contribution, I think, has been to remind us that the global brain is already here and has been here since the beginning of time, and is actually operating on an atomic scale, that the universe itself is intelligent in ways that we're just beginning to understand, and that, you know, there's been creativity happening throughout the ages. You know, we today as humans think that, you know, we invented that, but in fact we're just the latest technology. Beyond him, of course, Ray Kurzweil with his concepts of the singularity, extremely important thinker. One of the best things about Kurzweil's work is that he's really quantified and calculated a number of important trends in, for example, the rate of growth of computation and so forth, which helped to establish some basis for making some actual concrete predictions about when certain technological changes are going to happen in the future. And his concept of the singularity, of course, which you mentioned earlier, is a very important idea today and is debated often. Will there be a singularity? When will the singularity happen, and what will it be like? And then finally, I would add Kevin Kelly, the former editor of Wired magazine. Kevin has been working, writing books and papers about his views on collective intelligence. He thinks of the web, what he calls it, as the one machine. It's the most powerful machine ever built. It's global. It uses 5% of the world's electricity. It never breaks or fails. It never stops. You can't turn it off. You know, it's arguably the greatest thing we've ever made. And so he talks about the web and its collective intelligence and where that's going. And I think he's doing some wonderful, wonderful work on that.
Well, that's, you know, those are some very interesting ideas and people that you brought forward. And I'm just thinking in 2012, they're saying there's going to be a solar max. So what effect will that have on this sort of global brain that still is really dependent on computational power? And then this other concept of cogito ergo sum, I guess, I think, therefore I am.
Well, yeah, two things there. So, you know, obviously, if there's a solar max and we do have, you know, terrible solar storms, which some people have predicted, that will be, I think, something that will be catastrophic, but we'll survive it. You know, even if major pieces of our infrastructure get fried by electrical storms, you know, we'll be able to recover from that. So, you know, I think it may be problematic, it may be very disruptive, but I don't think it'll be the end of the world. As far as, you know, I think, therefore I am. I actually, as a Buddhist, look at it the other way. I think it's I am, therefore I think, which is, I think, more of a Buddhist view on that. So, you know, I guess, you know, the question that you're getting at, and which I also think about a lot, is the question of whether or not the collective global brain that we're creating will become conscious. And what does that mean? Will it be conscious like a human is conscious, or in a different way? You know, what is consciousness? That's a very important question. And that's the question that, for me, is the reason that I'm interested in Buddhism. You know, I got interested in Buddhism because I was interested in consciousness. And we'll, I'm sure, talk about that later in this interview.
I guess it sort of ties into, you know, Penrose's work in this area about consciousness and what it means. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about the argument that there will be an emerging global brain, and we talked about this already, the worldwide mind, and what are your views on the emergence of a global group of simply connected entities of independent people?
Well, you know, I do think that the worldwide mind is already here. It's existed for ages. It started with the beginning of oral traditions, when people would communicate stories that would travel around the world. Some of those stories, like Aesop's fables, you know, still exist even today, and are still in the background of our childhoods and shape some of our early development. Later, with the printing press, with written language first and then the printing press, you know, we found new ways to communicate our ideas non-locally, so we could distribute them, you know, over greater distances, both in space and in time. So stone tablets last a really long time, and so does parchment. Printed books don't last quite as long, but they're easier to make. And so, you know, we have a lot of records, ancient records as well as current records, that are spreading over the world. With personal computers and computer networks, of course, and telephones and all of this other technology, we've created a even more efficient way to distribute our ideas more rapidly, more widely, and to replicate them even less expensively. And so you can look at all of these different technologies adding up to really improving the efficiency with which humans distribute knowledge. And beyond that, actually beginning to automate intelligence. You know, knowledge and intelligence are two different things. Knowledge is, you could say, the data, and the intelligence is the program or the process, that's what you do with the data. And we are actually distributing both of those functions. You know, it used to be that you could distribute only the knowledge, the books, but the intelligence lived in people's heads. So you had to have a person in a certain place to do something with the book. The next step is the intelligence will also be distributed, and we're seeing that happen with the beginnings of intelligent applications, the semantic web and so forth, where we're beginning to start to take the intelligence and make that something we can also distribute and replicate. By moving it out of specific software or specific people's heads, we're actually beginning to make expert systems or smart intelligent assistants, intelligent applications that can learn, can understand, can evolve, can grow, and also are independent of a specific location. That they are software. They can move around. They can be copied. So we're taking this next big step is to do for intelligence what we've done for knowledge. As that happens, then I really think we can start to say that, you know, intelligence lives on its own outside of us in the web. It is there in very, very primitive way today, but I think we're going to see big, big advances in the next 100 years in that space. And Kevin Kelly recently has been writing a little bit about this idea as well. He's actually calling for a search for intelligence on the web, basically like the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. What he's asking us to do is to search for intelligence on the web. And how would we find it? How would we detect it? How would we know it was there if we found it? So, you know, I think it's an important hypothesis that, you know, it's more likely that we're going to find intelligence, non-human intelligence, living out on the web than it is that we'll find it in outer space. At least, you know, it might happen sooner. And so I think, you know, that's a very interesting frontier to explore.
It sounds like something that you can get Paul Allen to fund as he was funding the SETI project.
Effectively, that is what he's doing. He has a number of projects that are working on the frontiers of artificial intelligence today.
Now, can you explain your key points about WebOS and the software understanding-based web, that is, machine understanding-based web?
Yeah.
And do you have any new updates since you published your map of web evolution?
So I think, you know, the WebOS, which is the notion of a web operating system or the web as an operating system, is something that is happening. The battle is really which operating system. It used to be a battle between operating systems like Microsoft Windows and the Mac operating system and Unix and Linux. Today the battle has shifted to, is it going to be Google, Amazon, you know, or Microsoft's cloud? Which cloud, or Apple? For that matter, which cloud is your application going to live on? Where is it going to get its storage? Where is it going to? What computing resources does your application draw on? So, you know, an operating system provides an interface between an application and a computer. And today, that operating system is no longer on the desktop. It's really, even though we have operating systems, the important operating system is out on the web. And so the question is, you know, when you write software, are you going to write it to Amazon, to Apple's cloud, which is coming, or you know, to Microsoft's cloud or some other cloud? Where does the back of your application actually live? So I think that battle hasn't finished yet. We don't know who's won that. You know, right now there's just fierce competition in that space, just like there was for the desktop operating system in the 90s. And I think, you know, where is this going in terms of when we talk about machine understanding? That's really the semantic web. That's a piece of this operating system. So, you know, within the web operating system, one of the things that it has to do is handle data. Just like we had file systems on our computers, effectively, you know, we need a file system in the cloud. And what is that file system going to be? Well, it could be a simple file system, sure, or it could be more sophisticated, like a database, and we have those out in the cloud. There's certain different kinds of databases you can use that live in the cloud. But the next step is to go beyond old-fashioned databases and start to use a semantic way of storing, retrieving, and connecting information. And so there, that's really where the semantic web comes in. And the big idea there is to mark up the information in a way that makes it understandable to any application that sees it. So the application doesn't have to know anything in advance. It doesn't have to be explicitly programmed to understand in advance some set of information. When it encounters new information, the information carries some other metadata which teaches the application what this information is for and how to use it. And so there will come a time, perhaps, when applications will be able to understand any data set. You could make a universal application that could find data about medicine, or data about cars, or data about shopping, or data about travel. And it would know what to do with that and be able to help you intelligently query and make sense of that data, even though it hadn't been programmed in advance to do that. And that would all be because it was able to use this semantic web or this metadata that describes, in a way the machines and software can understand, how to use that data. So that's an important piece of the WebOS. If it develops, I think it will enable a much more universal, powerful, more intelligent application. The question is not really if, it's when and how will this happen. The original proposal came from the Worldwide Web Standards Organization, the W3C. And Tim Berners-Lee and other people there proposed a set of open standards for the semantic web, including some special languages called RDF and OWL, which allow applications to make sense of data and reason on this data in a new way that doesn't require them to know in advance what the data is. Those standards have not been widely adopted, unfortunately. They were actually, I think, good proposals. But if you look at where technology is going today, it's not doing that. Big companies are really trying to do what's simplest and cheapest right now, even if it means it won't be as universal, even if it means it will be more difficult. And what this really gets at is a trade-off between throwing a lot of computing power at problems and, you know, not necessarily doing things the most efficient way, but using a tremendous amount of computing power, or, you know, trying to do things in a more elegant, efficient way so that you don't have to use as much computing power. And what's interesting, and this kind of comes back to Kurzweil, is that it's getting so cheap to throw a lot of computing power at problems that, in fact, you might as well just do it the inefficient way. It's simple. It's cheap. It's, you know, you can do it. So that's what I think a lot of companies such as Google and others are doing. Rather than adopting and using difficult but powerful standards like the semantic web, they're just using brute force computing to try to figure out what data means. It's not nearly as efficient. Perhaps it takes a lot more computation, but so what? Computing's so cheap. So this is something that I think Tim Berners-Lee and the people who invented the semantic web hadn't planned on or hadn't thought about, which is that Moore's law, basically shows that the price of computing is going to continue to get less expensive and as power continues to go up, computing power goes up. And so if that's the case, maybe just with very brute force computing, we'll be able to do things as or even more powerful than what the semantic web standards were designed to enable. So either way, I think we will eventually get to a web OS that includes a layer that does very smart things with data. And it will understand what the data means and be able to make connections for you. It will function in a way that's more like the way our own minds function. We learn something, we don't have to think about it. We just stick it in our memory, it's there. It starts to connect to other things that are relevant. Then we can use that knowledge in the future as we do other things. It's kind of difficult to do that across applications today, but I think it's going to get easier. And whether it's through these standards of the semantic web or whether it's just through brute force computing, I think we'll get there. If you believe Ray Kurzweil, that will happen within a few decades. If you're a little more skeptical, which I actually happen to be, I think it may take a little bit longer than that. But I think one way or the other, it will happen.
Well, I guess there's been enormous strides made in what you call or what would be termed machine learning, and it's being used widely today. So, and that's sort of the brute force method. Now, what do you mean by the singularity in 2029, and that is a human brain equals $1? And
well, that's really a Kurzweil idea. Over the years, there have been different dates predicted for when the singularity will happen. One set of predictions, shows that in 2029, the computing power necessary or equivalent to the computing power of a single human brain will cost about $1. That is, for a dollar, you could have as much computation as the human brain does. Now, if that's true, that's amazing. It would mean, for example, that you could be wearing a wristwatch that was as computationally powerful as a human brain. You could have a human brain in every software application. You could have human brains effectively out on the web. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky. First of all, how much computation does the human brain really do? Well, this figure, which Ray Kurzweil and his people came up with, is based on some assumptions about the level of at which computation happens in the brain. Basically, they're assuming that computation happens only at the level of neurons. But in fact, that may not be true. There is research that shows that computation happens at many deeper levels, smaller than neurons in the brain. At the chemical level, for example, at the level of the interfaces between connections between neurons. So, in fact, there's even evidence that it happens at a quantum level in structures called microtubules that are very, very small and within the structure of the brain. So these are many orders of magnitude smaller than neurons. And if that's true, then there's actually a lot more computation happening in the brain than Kurzweil thought when he made that computation. And so what that means is, in fact, it may take a lot longer for the actual amount of computation happening in the human brain to cost only a dollar. But let's forget about the question of how long it takes for a minute. Will it ever happen? If we had an infinite amount of time, will it ever happen? That's an interesting question. Will we ever be able to do as much computation as the human brain does? That's a pretty deep question because we don't really know today whether the human brain is actually separate from the rest of the universe. It gets to that question where, are we really isolated or are we all part of the whole? If, in fact, the computation that the human brain does is at such a deep quantum level that it's somehow connected to the very fabric of reality, then it will be difficult to separate that from computation about space and time, computation that's the universe itself. On some level, technology is going to take us back to the same set of questions that Taoism and Buddhism have taken us to as well, and Hinduism for that matter. At the end of the day, the question is, who am I and how am I connected to the universe? What is all of this? How does it work? What's the connection between self and other? we are going to get back to that question through technology eventually, because when we start looking at this level, this question of where is the computation happening? Is it my brain or is it the universe? What's doing the computation? You know, ultimately we may find that, you know, every brain is really just a piece of a much larger computer, the universe, and that you can't separate those two things. You can't separate the brain from the universe. It's one system. If that's the case, then it'll never be possible to put the amount of computation that's actually happening into anything, because effectively there's an infinite amount of computation happening. And, you know, certainly we won't be able to get an infinite amount of computation for a dollar anytime soon. So it's a deep philosophical question. But, you know, on a technical level, whether it's all of the computation in the human brain or just a huge amount of computation, I think it will happen within a few decades that we'll get to a huge amount of computation very inexpensively. That's going to change our lives. It's going to change the world. There are many things today which we aren't doing right now with computers simply because it's too expensive to do the computation. But when the price of computation gets that much cheaper and it's that much smaller, it's easier to access or it's accessible over the web, we'll see very powerful computation showing up in devices that we don't see it in today. For example, in phones, you know, being able to listen and automatically annotate a phone call, take really good notes, make connections, and perhaps on a little display while you're talking to somebody, make suggestions or show you reminders or link to related files. You could do amazing things just analyzing the content of a phone call and augmenting it during the call. You could do the same thing for video conferencing. You could do the same thing for walking down the street or driving your car. All of these just require a lot of computation, and the only reason that stuff isn't happening right now is because computation is still too expensive.
I guess then this extends into quantum computing, twin particle effect, and all the possibilities that can come from all of that. Now, the next question is about the global brain, not just being related to information technology, but also philosophy, sociology, economics, politics, and cultural anthropology, and so on. We could even say it's related to the next state in civilization. The question, who are you, is based on our evolutionary definition of the concept human. Can you sort of give some of your ideas on how matter becomes imagination, this idea, this by a book by Nobel Prize winner Gerald Edelman?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been speaking about this already, I think, in this discussion today a little bit, and we'll elaborate on it a little bit more. So the global brain, you know, touches on a lot of these deep issues, and, you know, it's really just an idea at this point. Just like the notion of self is an idea. We kind of walk around without really thinking about that very much, but, you know, we have this convenient notion of self, our identity, who I am, or my personality. We even say things like, this is my body, this is my head, this is my thought. Well, who is saying that? That's the question. Who's the one who owns or thinks that it owns these things, this body, you know, these thoughts? Well, you know, we kind of naively assume there really is somebody there, the owner, and we think that's me or us or whoever we think we are. That's an assumption that most people just don't question. When you question it, that's the beginning of the spiritual path. It's also, I think, an interesting question, you know, for the internet and the web. We can look at this question both for the individual as well as for the global brain as a whole. You know, when we talk about the global brain, analogous things might arise. If there ever is a global brain, will it have a self? Will it have one self or many? Will that be an actual real thing that we can point to, or will it just be some data somewhere that's just a bunch of labels, but not really an actual self? So what is a self? Same question, just a different level of scale. The brain, you know, if you actually open it up and look inside it, it's just a collection of different parts, you know, hundreds of millions of different structures, billions of them actually, neurons, connections, but there's no one thing in there that you can point to that's the self. And with the global brain, it's the same thing. If you actually looked at the global brain, you'd see lots of people, lots of computers, lots of software, and lots of data, lots of infrastructure. But, you know, all of these are separate parts. Nowhere can you find anything that is the brain or even, you know, the self in that. So this question applies equally at both levels of scale. Now, it's also interesting that, you know, if there really was something that we could call a self that was a kind of special thing that, you know, could only be created, for example, by God, then that would mean it would be unlikely, or perhaps, who knows, you know, whether or not that would ever happen for the global brain, because, you know, we wouldn't know how to create this special thing. But the good news is, in a way, that, you know, from all the evidence we've seen, we can't find anything that's an actual self. The self is basically some kind of a concept or an illusion that we maintain because it helps us think, but it's not really there. Because of that, in fact, it means it's possible that there could be a self for the global brain, that it could emerge, that it could be constructed, because it is just a construct. So sort of the bad news is that we can't find the self. The good news is that means that we can create selves at other levels of scale. It means that you could have an artificial intelligence that had a concept of self. You could someday maybe have a disembodied kind of concept of self or structure that was that functioned like a self for the global brain. It's certainly possible. Now, whether it will happen, who knows? A lot of things would need to take place, and it, you know, maybe it's unlikely, but it's possible. So this concept of a human and what it is to be alive, what it is to be a being, as we explore the frontiers of both neuroscience and computer science, is shifting. And in a way, this is kind of similar to what happened to our understanding of matter as we developed the frontiers of physics, biology, chemistry in the previous centuries. It's analogous. So we're effectively doing for a new frontier, the frontier of mind, what we've already done for the frontier of matter. And what it is we're going to discover that just like we eventually found out that, you know, matter decomposes effectively infinitely to this kind of quantum stuff, well, we're going to find the same thing is true of the mind, that it also, you know, reduces and continues and you never find an end. You get down to this kind of quantum stuff. And, you know, interestingly, quantum mechanics itself has already established that there's some strange relationship between matter and consciousness. We don't really understand it, but we can show that observation does affect the outcome of an experiment. In fact, it's so strange, there are experiments that actually prove that this effect even travels through time, so that it actually can influence things backwards or forwards in time. It's a very strange, nobody really understands it today. But we know through numerous different directions of inquiry that there's a relationship between mind, what we call mind, and what we call matter. Well, if we jump over to the other side, to the spiritual way of looking at things, you know, all the great spiritual traditions have already discovered this a long time ago. From their perspective, it's all really one thing. Mind and matter, those concepts are dualistic concepts. They're artificial distinctions. There's really not any separation between all these different phenomena that we observe. They're all manifestations of something deeper. So I think technology and spirituality are kind of engaged in this sort of dance, and that's been going on really for centuries. You know, the church, other great religions have been deeply involved in science. Many great scientists have been deeply religious, because when you ask these big questions, you inevitably start to experience this kind of wonder and awe and mystery, and you even start to realize that there are things that we'll probably never understand, or that can't be understood, because that's what they are. They're not understandable. So I think when we talk about this question of, you know, how matter becomes imagination or matter becomes consciousness, you know, there's a lot of thinking going on about this right now, trying to find the source of consciousness. The approach that's being taken in the book that you're referring to is still a very mechanistic approach, materialistic approach, trying to find some physical thing in the brain that corresponds to consciousness, whether it's a process or, in this case, it's a particular pattern or way that neurons fire under certain conditions that's the source of consciousness. Well, I don't think that's going to succeed. I think that those approaches may find some analogs, some things that, you know, are correlated in the brain with certain experiences that we have. So, you know, when we see something that we recognize, there's a neural signature, and you can detect that, and that's the basis, for example, of next-generation lie detectors, which can actually detect whether you've seen or are remembering something by looking at the neural fingerprint of that experience in your brain. So we'll be able to see some correlations between sensory experiences or mental experiences and the brain. But that doesn't actually locate the source of consciousness. That locates perhaps the source of conception or of concepts, where those concepts are, how those are firing or how they're being experienced in the brain. But when we talk about consciousness, there's a very specific distinction that we have to make, and that is, what do we really mean by consciousness? Do we mean just this entire landscape of thought, or do we mean something more precise, that is, the entity that's actually aware or that is knowing or witnessing what's taking place? These are two very, very different phenomena, and in the West, When we talk about consciousness, we don't make that distinction. We're very messy when we talk about this. In Eastern philosophy, they're very, very precise about this. In Buddhism, for example, there are very, very precise distinctions for all of the different phenomena that take place within the field of consciousness. When you experience something, there are many, many different things going on in that experience, and there's labels and names and technical descriptions of all of these. That's still very lacking in Western cognitive science and neuroscience. We have very, very simple, primitive language. We barely understand or even talk about what's going on in consciousness. In the East, in Eastern philosophical traditions, they're much more sophisticated. They've had multiple thousands of years of dialectical debate and research, and they've developed very, very, very sophisticated logic and precise analytical methods and language for explaining what's going on in consciousness. So what this gets to, ultimately, the conclusion of this, is that we might be able to find some analogs, some physical analogs for thoughts or experiences, but we won't be able to find the thing that's knowing. That's different. That's something else, and it doesn't have a neural signature. We won't be able to find it. And that's a statement that I'm confident in making, because there are logical arguments as well as experiments that you can do in your own meditation, for example, where you can see that and you can establish that, and you know it's true. And it's not a matter of a belief. It's more like an existence proof. It's like a mathematical truth. It's something that you can find, you can show, other people can repeat it, and it's not something that's actually even debatable once you actually see that. So, you know, of course, that's something which a scientist would probably scoff at and say, oh, please, you know, that's just another statement by a spiritual person who's not a scientist. Well, you know, I happen to be both. So I'm spiritual, but I'm also a scientist. And I can say, you know, having looked on both sides of the coin, that there really is something special taking place when it comes to awareness, to the source of knowing. Phenomena that we know, appearances that occur to us, you know, experiences we have through our senses, they aren't as important or as interesting. They're special too. But the really interesting question is what's knowing those things? What is that actual awareness, the very root of the whole question? So I think through science we will never be able to answer that question.
Fascinating. All of these ideas that you're putting out and gives much pause for everybody to contemplate. I guess it goes into this next question, and that is, you know, Alex says, I think of the evolution of the Internet starts with the evolution of philosophical thinking. And he talks about the founder of LinkedIn being a philosopher. And he says, you're a philosopher as the founder of Radar Networks. And philosopher Nelson Goodman said, the world is made rather than the world is discovered. And Alex says, for me, my ideas are influenced by Popper, Kuhn, Laszlo. Can you share who influenced you and tell us something about your philosophy?
Well, you know, I think, you know, when I was a student, I studied Western philosophy first, you know, starting with Plato, and working my way forward, and went through, you know, all the classic and standard philosophers that one is supposed to study. I also studied science and the history of science and the philosophy of science, you know, and was very interested in Thomas Kuhn, of course, but also, you know, increasingly interested in the work of people like John Searle. John Searle actually, you know, has a famous and very relevant example for this discussion, which is actually called the Chinese Room. It's the famous Chinese Room thought experiment, and the purpose of this is to question what it is to actually know the meaning of something. And here's how the experiment works. You've got a man, and you imprison him in some room somewhere, and he does not speak Chinese. Let's say he only speaks English. Now what you do is you then hand him a question. It's written in Chinese. You slide it under the door on a piece of paper. It's written in Chinese. Now he can't read Chinese. He doesn't know what this thing means. But in the room is a big book, and that book is basically a set of instructions. And it says, if you see this character, then write this character. You know, if you see this group of characters, then write that group of characters. It's a set of instructions. And through following that set of instructions, he generates a response, which he writes on another piece of paper. Basically, he gets this input in Chinese. He goes through the instructions, follows the instructions, and he writes a response, and he slides that back out onto the door. So on the other side, you get that response, and it happens to be a perfect answer to your question. Now, here's the thing. If you don't know what's going on inside that room, you would think, well, this guy knows, he speaks Chinese. He understood my question, and he answered it. He must have known the meaning, and so, you know, he understands Chinese. But in fact, if you can see inside the room, if you know what's going on in there, then you'd see, no, he doesn't understand Chinese at all. He's just following instructions. So this is a metaphor for a deep question about what's going on with computers and artificial intelligence and in the human brain. What does it mean to really know something or to really experience the meaning of something? John Searle called that the qualia of an experience. So, for example, if you see the color red, there's something about that, the qualia, he would call it, of the experience of seeing the color red that we just can't really put into words. It's the redness of the red. It's the experience of really seeing that. The question is that the same as just following instructions? For example, when this guy in the Chinese room is answering this question in Chinese, does he actually understand? Is he experiencing the meaning of the question, the meaning of the answer? Does he get the qualia, if you will, of what's being discussed? No, of course not. He has no understanding of what's going on. He's just following instructions. That's different than somebody who really does speak and understand Chinese. When they get the question, they actually know something. They're experiencing something, and then they're generating an answer. That's different than just following some instructions. Another good example is chocolate. If somebody describes what it's like to taste chocolate to a person who's never had chocolate, they're not really going to understand, because you can't really understand chocolate until you actually taste it yourself. There's no way to convey or describe. Same with a fine wine. There's no way you could explain that experience to somebody because it has a qualia. So John Searle's notion of qualia is very influential for me, and I think tied in very nicely to a lot of my questions when I was in college and when I was studying philosophy of mind, you know, about this nature of consciousness and what it is to know something. And I was primarily interested in this because I was trying to create artificial intelligence. That was kind of my goal while I was in college. I wanted to create artificial intelligence. And so I was doing a lot of computer science research and experiments and building software, searching for this. Along the way, another very important influence was a scientist in the United States named Ed Fredkin. Not very well known. But he is one of the founding fathers of a field called digital physics. His basic idea, and he, of course, is not the only one in the field. There are many others I should mention. Stephen Wolfram is a very, very well-known person in this field as well. Others were Tommaso Toffoli and Norman Margolis at MIT, who I actually did some research with. This concept of digital physics is that the universe is effectively a giant computer, and it's basically doing massive universal-scale computation, and we are just effectively computer programs. This is all effectively a big simulation. It's the closest thing there is to reality. There's nothing better, but it's still a computer program. So that's a view which I got very interested in when I was in college. And actually, one of the reasons I was so interested in it is because you can actually do some experiments using a technology called cellular automata that go in this direction. There's a famous cellular automata program, which is called the Game of Life. Anybody can get it. You can put it on your computer. And what it does is it basically has these patterns that grow and evolve and move around in a very lifelike way. But what's interesting is that the computation that's driving that is incredibly simple. It just looks at every point and looks at the points around it and counts the number of points around it that are either colored dark or light. And if a certain number are colored light, you know, if they're white and you can see those pixels, then it turns the pixel white. And if a certain number are black, then it turns it black. It's that simple. That little rule applied at every pixel on the screen, effectively, generates these unbelievably lifelike, dynamic, animated patterns that even have stable things that move around and interact. It's like a whole world. It's an amazing thing. Turns out there's a huge array of different possible cellular automata systems like that. Stephen Wolfram really is the person who's done the most looking at the space of all the possible systems that you could create in this paradigm. Anyway, what was interesting with digital physics is that it provides, you know, with cellular automata, it provided a workbench or platform that you could actually do some experiments with and play around with. And so through exploring cellular automata, I took it to a deeper level beyond just, you know, consciousness and mind, and started thinking, well, is the whole universe a computation? And then again, there's this question of qualia. So if you were going to simulate the universe, is there a difference between, for example, a simulated apple and a real apple? What's the difference? Is there a difference between, you know, a simulated person and a real person? Are we living in a simulation? I know this is actually a question that you'll probably be getting to. So I started thinking a lot about that. And that these kinds of questions really are what drove me eventually to get interested in Buddhism, which really became a strong interest of mine. It was an interest all my life, actually, but it became a really strong interest in college when I reached this point in philosophy and physics where, you know, I really found the edge that you know, our current theories just couldn't get near. And I wanted to see what was over the edge. And so, you know, I really came to the conclusion that our approach in Western materialistic science will not actually give us much of a view over the edge. And that if we really want to see what's going on at a larger scale, if we want to see outside the system that we're in, if we want to see, you know, the background, not the foreground, then, you know, you have to go to a different level. And that's why I got interested in meditation, because that's what meditation focuses on. It focuses on what's beyond all the other things that you can focus on. And so that was kind of the thing that pushed me, I guess, to transcend, if you will, the limitations of the Western view.
That's fascinating, and I guess it sort of extends beyond Dennett, Daniel Dennett, and sort of consciousness explained, or the work of Brooke at MIT, or, you know, this sort of insect behavior being modeled very simply by very simple rules and computers. And there's this next question, and Alex says he's one of the advisors of the Peter Drucker Academy in China, and he wrote an article in 2009, the year of 100 years in celebration of Peter Drucker. He says, I hold in high esteem his knowledge society, and I'm putting all my efforts to make it happen through ChinaValue.net. What do you see as the top three influences of your grandfather, and how has your grandfather's global influence shaped your thinking in your life? And he commented that Mr. Drucker once commented, knowledge is enterprise. And then Alex is asking, can you please comment on how knowledge sharing, creation, and management helps business?
Yes. You know, my grandfather, one of the things about my grandfather that I think many people appreciated was that he connected across different disciplines. His mind really wasn't limited to just one field. And he made amazing connections and really integrated different fields, different trends, or different thoughts in ways that people had never seen before. And I think, you know, what I appreciated the most about, you know, growing up and having, you know, the privilege of, you know, him spending time with me, especially in the summer times, we would take walks in the mountains and we would have these long conversations, just he and I, is really how he would connect things together. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, he thought of management, you know, as a liberal art, because it really did connect all of these different things together. And in particular, it was really about people. It had a humanistic focus. So, you know, some people think of management as a science, like say management science. He didn't think it was a science. He felt it was an art, a liberal art, like philosophy, like psychology, like history or economics even, which, you know, is on the edge. But anyway, he really had this incredible knowledge of history in particular. I think one of the most impressive things about him was that he really knew world history, not just U.S. history or European history, but Asian history, you know, Muslim history. He knew it all. He really had this incredible knowledge base in his mind, history, and he could bring that to the foreground anytime he wanted. So you'd have a discussion with him, and he'd be spouting off, you know, names, dates, you know, historical examples for whatever it is that you were talking about. That's something which rarely happens anymore. Very rarely do you ever hear anything about history, let alone anything that makes history relevant today. And that's something that we've lost. I think wisdom, when we think of wisdom, a big piece of wisdom is actually history. It's learning. It's the lessons of the past. It's from your ancestors. It's from the elders. It's the benefit of experience and time. That's something that my grandfather really had. He had incredible wisdom. He was a very wise, real kind of guru, really. He was the kind of person that you just don't really meet that often anymore. And in our civilization, we don't focus on that anymore. You know, our civilization is focused on the present, on the now. We are not really thinking very much about the past or even about the future. And by the way, that's a big shift, something I think about a lot, that we're moving into this era where we're completely focused on the present, on the now, a now-centric civilization. You know, in the agricultural era, we were focused on the past because we had to be, because we needed to understand patterns from the past in order to understand what was going to happen with our crops. When we went into the industrial age, we got focused on the future because it was all about progress and innovation. But now we're in the information age, and it's all about the present, because we have to just be in the present to cope with the amount of information and change that we have to deal with all the time. Well, anyway, my grandfather was definitely somebody who was not stuck in the present. He was thinking about the past, he was thinking about the future, and he was bringing those into the present. So he was constantly connecting all of these different timescales to everything that he was doing. And when you went to talk with him, he would always connect those. That was a big influence. Another big influence was that he is well known for have come up with the term knowledge worker, knowledge work. And so he really pioneered this whole idea that instead of creating value with their hands, people were going to create value with their mind, and that was going to be the next big thing. That was going to be the big focus of the future century. He was completely right about that. And I think we all today, we're all knowledge workers. We all see this. And in fact, almost everybody is a knowledge worker. Fewer and fewer people are not knowledge workers. I mean, there are still laborers. There are, and there's a lot of them. But that even laborers are becoming knowledge workers as technology reaches into their jobs and connects them, either by giving them information, getting information from them, assisting them. When you call somebody in a call center, a computer is now assisting them and giving them information as you're talking to them. Well, that's turned that person from basically a laborer into a knowledge worker. Even somebody, working in a factory, they're now working with robots and with displays and information systems as they assemble things. So they're now also knowledge workers. So more and more, this knowledge work is penetrating all aspects of our civilization. And I think, my grandfather really, with me, spent a lot of time discussing the implications of that, and also, of course, my own ideas about collective intelligence, the global brain, and whether or not enterprises, whether you could create brains or things that functioned like minds for organizations and governments even. So that's something I've thought about a lot. Could you make groups smarter? Could you take some of the things I've been thinking about and build systems that would enable groups to be more intelligent the way that humans are intelligent, perhaps, or even just slightly more intelligent than groups are today? And would that make a difference? So we debate about that a lot. And we had a lot of debates about whether or not organizations were organisms. One debate I remember with him was really focused on that. And I took the position that organizations really were organisms. And interestingly, he actually argued against that. He didn't think they were living organisms. He didn't feel that. He focused on the individuals. He felt the organisms were the people, and the organization was a kind of non-living, almost like a shell. But it was an interesting debate that we had. And then I think, later in his life, a big focus was what he called the social sector, what other people I also call the social sector, which is this sector of our economy that fulfills certain roles that government used to fulfill. And that could be providing medical care or mental health care or relief agencies, charities, these functions which help people in need, to provide education or food or shelter. Traditionally those would have been considered to be functions that government would fulfill, but that's shifted. And so in the later part of my grandfather's life, he really focused on helping nonprofit organizations and helping the social sector to develop new disciplines, new tools, and to become more professional, really, more mature, more evolved as a sector, just like he had done the first part of his career for the corporate kind of for-profit sector of the economy. So really, in the later part of his life, that was a big focus for him. And I think, that was something that I'm still just beginning to understand myself. I mean, I've done certainly a lot of work, charitable work of my own, but, I think my grandfather's thinking on that is something which I'm not as familiar with. The area where he and I really, I think, connected the most was around knowledge work.
I can see the influences, though, and then you adding to those influences to make your long-lasting historical contributions. And it's really interesting, this idea of reaching back into the past and sort of integrating those lessons, sort of contrary to sort of what Eckhart Tolle and sort of this new earth and now, just kind of living in the now, or this concept of, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it, and, maybe they're in conflict, and how do you resolve that? Now, in your social semantics solution, how do you deal with this fragmentation of the semantic web? And a follow-up question would be, and Alex, and I'm quoting him directly, he says, "I think the simulation of Nick Bostrom's hypothesis sounds like a contemporary version of the incompleteness theorem of Gödel in mathematics. What are your views on this?"
Well, the first part of the question, how do you deal with the fragmentation of the semantic web? What that question is asking is, when we were talking earlier about, could we come up with a way for computers to understand data without having to be programmed in advance to know what that data means. And there were these standards that were created by the World Wide Web Consortium and Tim Berners-Lee, who's the inventor of the internet, of the web. These standards for the semantic web were designed to get everybody using sort of one language for saying what data means, what a piece of data means, so that all applications, all software could understand it. If those standards had been widely adopted, which hasn't happened, then, you know, we would solve this problem of fragmentation. The fragmentation problem is that I program my application to understand my data. But when your application sees my data, it can't understand it. It doesn't know what the basic assumptions were. What was this field supposed to be for? You know, you used this weird special label on the field. What does that label mean? Is this a price or is it a date? You know, what does this number mean? What is it supposed to be? What do I use it for? How do I interpret the data? So this problem, the semantic web was trying to solve that. So for example, if you had a customer record in your database, you could define each field in a way, you know, what does this mean? This is their first name, this is their last name, this is their company, this is their address. Well, can we define those terms in a kind of universal way so that any application could get that customer record and say, oh, this is a customer record, and I know exactly where to find their address, or I know exactly where to find, I know which field is their most recent purchase, for example. So, you know, you can't do that today because there is no standard that everybody's using for defining data records. Well, the semantic web was trying to solve that. And since it hasn't been adopted, we don't have a solution. And so the answer is my social semantic solution does not solve that problem. That problem has to be solved by standards. And unless people adopt those standards, it won't be solved. You know, there's one other option, which is brute force computing, which maybe someday will be smart enough that we won't need the standard because it will be as smart as a person and your application can just see the data and figure it out for itself. That might happen. But in the near future, we're going to have this fragmentation. That is, some applications are going to understand some data and some applications are not going to understand that data. And that's just the way it is. And it's going to be messy. People are going to have to do lots of work to integrate things. And all of that could, you know, annoyance could be avoided if people adopted these simple open standards. But they're not doing that for various reasons, some of which are competitive. That is, by not making your data open, it makes it harder for other companies to do something with it, which means that they have to use your software. And that's actually a strategy which has been used very successfully by Microsoft, for example, and others for decades. Google's doing the same thing. And so, you know, until it becomes more valuable to a company to get everybody else using their data than it is to keep them from using their data, I think we'll continue to see fragmentation. But in certain areas, maybe, it will start to change. For example, around systems integration, for example, you definitely need to integrate data. There's a very big value there, and that's actually where the semantic web has been applied the most. Those standards have been used in systems integration and to solve some of those problems. So, you know, I think that's going to continue to be an issue. And what I'm doing with Bottlenose, which is a kind of social semantic network, it's basically like Twitter but semantic. That is, it's a much richer, smarter system. And it works with Twitter, but it's just a much smarter environment. We have our own semantics, if you will, for defining what different pieces of data mean. And we hope to make that open and to share that and to support some open standards as well so other people can do something with that data in the future. But that's stuff that will happen in the future because we haven't even launched the product yet. Now, the second question is about Nick Bostrom's simulation hypothesis. And, you know, that's a very interesting and important concept. Basically, in a nutshell, it says Nick Bostrom's simulation hypothesis essentially says that it's statistically the probabilities indicate that it's likely that we are living in a simulation. That's a simplification. In fact, there are three scenarios. It's actually three questions, and one of the, you know, two first questions, you know, basically have the effect of asking, you know, are you living in a simulation? Effectively, do civilizations that reach a certain level of sophistication generate simulations of reality? And if that doesn't happen, okay, fine, then statistically you're not living in a simulation. But statistically, looking at various possibilities, it's more likely that we are living in a simulation if, in fact, civilizations are capable of evolving to the level that they can do that. So basically, if civilizations can ever evolve to the point where they generate simulations of reality, then it's likely that we ourselves are living in one of those simulations. It's very difficult to explain. It's very difficult to understand, in fact. It's pretty heavy reading. But the gist of the question is, are we living in a simulation? Now, I'm not sure exactly how that relates to fragmentation of the semantic web, so I'll treat it as a sort of different question. But my answer to that question, I think that it's the wrong question, because ultimately, if we are living in a simulation, then that it means it's very likely that that simulation is also happening in a higher level simulation. And so if you follow Nick Bostrom's hypothesis to its conclusion, it's simulations all the way down, which is actually something that you used to say in physics. They used to say it's turtles all the way down, which is based on a famous case where an old lady came into a physics lecture, and the physicist was talking about the universe, and she said, oh, forget about all that stuff. The universe is on the back of a giant turtle. And he said, well, what's that turtle on? She said, oh, it's turtles all the way down. That is, the turtle's on another turtle, and so forth. Well, I think with Nick Bostrom's simulation hypothesis, effectively, one of the problems is that it leads to the conclusion that it's simulations all the way down. And so it doesn't necessarily tell us anything that useful. It doesn't, for example, mean that there's one thing outside this that's simulating it. It's more likely that if we're living in a simulation, that that simulation's in another simulation. And so it's endless. I think it's a mind game, basically. At the end of the day, who cares? What's useful about that? What does that change? If we were in a simulation, how would we live differently? Well, we wouldn't, because it's such a good simulation that it seems like it's real. But I think this does touch a lot on thoughts about consciousness, the nature of consciousness, and some of my interest in Buddhism, for example, because basically those lines of thought touch on this. Effectively, the conclusion of Buddhism is that nothing is actually as real as it seems. This kind of notion of real, this word we use, real, needs to be investigated. So effectively, you could say everything's like a simulation, that everything that's appearing from the perspective of Buddhism, everything that's appearing has the status, the ontological status of a mental event. That is, when you see something like a chair across the room or a window, that's not a real chair, it's not a real window, it's an image or an appearance of a window or a chair that's appearing to you, and it's different for somebody else. It's not the same for anyone else. Nobody sees the same thing that you see. Everybody has a different experience. So effectively, all we really know is that, we have our experience, and we don't know if there is anyone else or anything else that experiences that experience the way we do. Everybody can only really measure their own experience. And so effectively, the world is a set of experiences. The universe is a set of experiences. And those experiences are conscious, mental events. That's what they actually are. So the Buddhist view is that, what we call the universe or life or reality is this collection of mental events that we're labeling as self or other, and we're calling or as real or as the universe. When you actually look for those things and try to find them, you find basically that you can't find them. You find things you could call consciousness or, the Buddhist term emptiness. You find these different results, but they aren't things themselves that you can actually grasp. They're concepts. Like the void, like emptiness, like space. You can't grasp those things. So from the Buddhist view, this is a simulation of sorts. The cause of the simulation, if you will, the software, is karma. That is this collected kind of reserve of cause and effect of previous actions. That's what's generating the simulation. It's the program, if you will. And where it's taking place, that's the interesting question. It's not the same answer as you get from Nick Bostrom, right? Nick Bostrom's answer basically says it's a simulation, and that simulation is probably happening in another simulation. It just goes on forever. In the Buddhist view, it's not like that. There's this whole simulation we're experiencing, but there is an ultimate layer that you can actually discover and you can establish through logic, in fact, as well as through your own direct experience. That's, if you will, the background. And that itself is not a simulation and is not in another simulation. It's not a phenomena that's a mental event. It's not a mental event. And so that's an important thing you have to find for yourself. It takes a lot of study and work and years of training. But you can find that, actually, in a manner of speaking. You can't grasp it like you could grasp other things that you find. But you can establish it. It has a certain ontological status. It has it is actually something that is more real than the things that we call real. And so from that perspective, we escape from this whole question, this infinite chain of simulations, infinite turtles, however you want to describe that. We get out of that infinite regress, which is a kind of logical fallacy. Now, in cognitive science, interestingly enough, we're arriving at similar conclusions, I think, eventually. As neuroscience and cognitive science really penetrate the mind and the brain and how that works from a physical perspective, We're also, you know, reaching this similar conclusion, I think, gradually, that we aren't going to be able to find a source for the simulation. You know, there are thoughts, there's stuff happening, but the thing that's experiencing those or generating those, we still can't find it. It doesn't, it's not in the brain. The brain is in it. So, you know, if we look at things very, very closely, with a very, very high resolution, fine-toothed kind of comb or, you know, very sharp razor, and we're very careful in making these distinctions and look very closely, it becomes clear. So, you know, this is something which, you know, it's hard to describe or prove in a very short conversation. You know, in my own case, it's taken me 30 years to reach kind of a level of, I think, really deep understanding of this. So it's not something that's easy to summarize. But, you know, it's a very important question, are we living in a simulation? I think it's a modern-day way of asking the same question that religions have asked. You know, is this all? Is this life all there is? Or is it real? It's a modern-day way of asking that question. But the answer that you get from Nick Bostrom, I think, is not the correct answer. It's not the right answer. The answer that you get from that is basically more concept, and that's not the answer. The answer is beyond concept.
We'll sort of turn this questioning back to this little global brain and semantic web. So in your view, what are the vision and milestones of the global brain and semantic web? And then the next question is, what would be the sort of the evolution in the business models in the near future with regards to these two?
Well, I think, you know, for the global brain and the semantic web, first of all, let's just define what's the relationship between those two things. The global brain, I think, already exists and has existed, you know, since we've had language. It's just gotten more and more global, and it's become more and more of a brain over time. You could just say it's the collective intelligence of humanity. The semantic web is a technology, recent technology, it's only a few decades old, which could provide some infrastructure that would make the global brain smarter. But the semantic web, you know, there are different ways to do it. There are different ways you could provide semantics, which is basically a meta language for saying what things mean. You know, when you see a word, when you see a piece of data, the semantic web gives you a way to define what that means so that machines can understand it. That's all. There are different approaches to doing that. And whether the semantic web ever happens or how it happens, doesn't make a difference for the global brain. I mean, sure, it might make the global brain smarter, it might make it smarter sooner, but at the end of the day, the global brain is already here, and it's going to happen no matter what we do. It's been evolving, you know, as long as there have been humans. And I think in terms of milestones, earlier in the discussion we talked about some key big leaps, for example, the invention of language, and then written language. So first there was spoken language, then written language, then, you know, the ability to print, printing presses, and then, of course, telecommunications networks, TV, phones, radios, then fax machines, then the Internet, the World Wide Web, which is the ultimate global printing press. And now the next step to do for intelligence what we've now done for knowledge, to start finding ways to get intelligence out of the minds of experts and embody that into software so that you could make software that could give you advice the way a doctor or a stockbroker might, for example. So, you know, that's the next big frontier in some ways, is to do for intelligence what we've done for knowledge. And I don't know, you know, how long it will take, but we do see it happening. Many, many applications for consumers have more intelligence in them than they used to have. And there are some that are really smart, that are personal assistants that will do tasks for you, for example, that you can even talk to. So I think we're really on the edge of that. Big milestones. Well, it's a great question and something that's actually really worth thinking about. You know, what would be some of the future milestones as the global brain evolves? I think, you know, it would be hard on the spot to give you a really good answer to what I think the milestones are. Probably be a great subject for a paper, actually. But I'll just throw a few ideas out there. I think a critical threshold is when in any collective is when the parts can no longer function independently of one another. They become a whole. So what is the distinction between a collection of parts and a thing that we think of as a whole? Right? You have the distinction of the part and the whole distinction, right? Well, let's look at this, some examples in biology. In evolution, there's this notion of symbiosis. And Lynn Margulis and others have done a lot of good thinking about that. And in particular, in symbiotic systems, you have different organisms that kind of happen to be near each other, and some of them are more successful and are able to survive and reproduce more effectively by teaming up in certain ways with others. So, for example, you might have single-celled organisms in a pond or in some little ecosystem. And some of them are really good at digesting some stuff, and others are really good at just sticking to stuff. Well, if the ones that are good at sticking to stuff, you know, are near the ones that are good at digesting stuff, then they can sort of team up. The sticky things kind of grab food particles, and then the digesting ones kind of dissolve them and break them down, and then the ones that are good at sticking to stuff can also benefit from some of those nutrients. And so these two different kinds of organisms, for example, can sort of cooperate. And they don't mean to. It just happens that, you know, they're useful to each other. But because of that, they become more successful. And so their populations increase together. And gradually, the way evolution works is that natural selection, just statistically, starts to favor versions of these organisms that are better at collaborating with one another. So, in fact, the organisms, for example, that are good at sticking to food particles, they don't have to work so hard at digesting because the digestion is handled by this other organism nearby that breaks them down, right? Well, you know, over many, many, many generations, gradually, if, you know, as these two populations of organisms next to each other continue to evolve, they start to specialize. So they don't have to be as general. They don't, you know, they don't have to both be able to say, you know, stick to food particles and digest them, because that labor is shared by specialists. And so they specialize. And gradually, as they specialize more and more, and of course this isn't intentional, this is just a statistical side effect, if you will, of evolution, of just mutations taking place, and some things living or dying. Gradually, their genes specialize so that eventually you get these organisms which literally they cannot survive on their own. They must be with the other type of organism to survive. They lose the ability to stick to food or to digest it on their own, for example. When that happens, there's a sort of critical point, a crossing over from parts to whole. They were separate organisms that could kind of exist on their own. They were just parts that happened to be together. There was no actual whole. But suddenly, there's this transition point where now they literally cannot function on their own. They can't live or survive apart from each other. So now it's a new whole. The organism has now shifted to a new level of order. The unit of evolution is no longer these individual things. It's the collection of things. And so that's when you get an organ instead of a bunch of different parts. You know, these different organisms become a new organism or a new organ. And it's interesting that if you actually look at our own cells, you find out that within them, there are some organelles that have their own DNA, and that DNA is different than our main DNA, within the mitochondria, for example. Evidence points to exactly what I just described having happened in our distant ancient past, that our own cells are formed from this kind of symbiosis that happened long ago. And so at some point in the distant ancient past, some different organisms came together and gradually formed the basis of what, you know, are our complex cells. And gradually, that same process continued, creating more and more sophisticated cells and even structures. And eventually, so the theory goes, that led to the kinds of organisms we have today. So we all, our bodies, really are the product of symbiotic natural selection and evolution. Well, that same biological phenomena may also happen, you know, in the case of the global mind. In that case, we look at it as a symbiosis of intelligence, of mind. There may come a time in the future where we really can't function or even think really individually anymore, that we will become so connected to the collective mind and so reliant, dependent on it really, that all of our thoughts, all of our actions, all of our decisions will be somehow influenced or part of it. Which brings us back to the beginning of this discussion today, where I was talking about this question of someday in the future, what will happen when all of our decisions are so augmented by the global mind, by the internet, by information coming from outside, that really we aren't really deciding on our own anymore when we take an action. The question will be, who's the actor? Who's acting? Who's making the decision? Who's doing it? Is it me or is it the global mind? Do I exist anymore, or am I just a neuron in the global brain? Who's actually doing this? When I drive my car down the street in the future and it's totally navigated by GPS, am I driving, you know, or is the global brain driving? So there will come a point, perhaps, when we'll have to ask that question, when our own thoughts, our own decisions will be so influenced and hooked in, connected to this feedback loop of the global brain, that we won't really be individuals anymore. When that happens, there'll be that crossing over point, just like what we saw in the example of single-celled organisms, you know, a long time ago. Something like that may happen on this higher level of scale. That is, our individual minds may specialize so much because of our ability to symbiotically rely on specialists, on other people, on information systems and services coming from the net, that we won't be able to function on our own. And when that happens, we will actually no longer be individuals. We will no longer be part. We will be a new kind of organism, a new species. So right now we think of humanity as these kind of things that walk around, you know, that look like we do. We're humans, right? We have certain DNA. We're humanity, and we consider ourselves to be the sort of state of the art in evolution on this planet. But it could move to a higher level, and that new organism will be a combination of humans and machines and software and maybe other species too. And we'll be operating on a global scale, that the new unit of evolution could be, you know, huge organizations that combine all of these things, or maybe the entire species as a whole, hooked in to this massive computing infrastructure. We'll no longer be just biological. There'll be a big part of our intelligence that is not biological, that exists only on the web and is in the form of artificial intelligence that we interact with. But we'll all be part of one system, one intelligence. So when that happens, if that happens, I think it probably will happen someday, that will be a major, major milestone. That will be the birth of a new species beyond what we think of as human. It will be transhuman or, you know, cybernetic type of species that will include, it will include humans, but it will be certainly much more than what we think of as a human biological body. So I think, you know, that is something, I can't say when it will happen, but I think it's a critical milestone. When that happens, we can really say, you know, the global brain is really mature. Until then, you know, the global brain is kind of a fuzzy, it's a concept, it's there in a sort of patchwork way. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. It functions very inconsistently, it's not so efficient. It hasn't really woken up, it's not really an organism or an entity in its own right. But when we cross that threshold, then we'll really be able to, I think, say that the global brain is an entity, that it's a living being, that it's conscious through us, and maybe through other forms of consciousness in it, that it's a new species, even. And who knows, you know, when we as a species and as a planet reach that level of evolution, if we manage to get to that point without destroying ourselves, if we reach that level of evolution where we can learn and operate and think collectively so much more intelligently than we do today, you know, will it be a better world? You know, will our lives be better? Well, they'll certainly be a lot more efficient. I don't know if they'll be better. If efficient doesn't always mean better. Sometimes inefficiencies are the things that are most fun. So it's an interesting question. But, you know, the next question is that milestone an important milestone as a planet that perhaps opens the door to contact or interactions with more advanced civilizations maybe that have reached that point that might exist off the planet? We don't know yet. You know, it certainly seems likely that we are not the only intelligent species in the universe. It's a big universe. And as we discover more and more Earth-like planets, the numbers are in our favor. There's very likely to be many advanced civilizations in our own galaxy. And if they've been around for a really, really long time, longer than us, long enough to have space travel that can get from their star to our star, they've also probably been around long enough to develop the computing power to go through their own singularity and also to develop a global brain for their own species that's like what I'm talking about. So it's likely that if any civilization has been around long enough that it could have the technology to come to us, they probably also have a kind of collective mind, because that's just the natural direction where evolution is heading. And for any technologically advanced civilization, that's probably where they end up. And so if we really want to interact and communicate with a civilization like that, you know, we probably need to be on the same level as them. For example, you know, an ant would have a very hard time communicating with a human, such different levels of intelligence. Well, you know, we individual humans may be like ants compared to the collective intelligences of very advanced civilizations that might exist. So if we really want to interact intelligently and on an equal level with these other civilizations that may exist, we have to first reach that level. And I think that's perhaps, you know, the next several thousand years perhaps of our intellectual evolution that may get us there. Maybe it'll happen sooner.
So the global brain is the Borg of the future.
I think so. I think the global brain, you know, the Borg, you know, the science fiction metaphor or concept from Star Trek, it's a very negative view of a global brain where, you know, by being in the global brain, you somehow become an automaton and kind of lose your value. You become like a worker bee in the hive and are expendable. That's one vision of a global brain, but that's not the only vision of it. You know, there are different ways a global brain could happen. It could happen in a way which actually values the individual, where the individual is not expendable, where the individual is a very important part of the global brain. Just like certain organs are very important in your body, just because they're, you know, they're not expendable. You can't live without your liver, right? So, same way, the role of individuals in our global brain may be, you know, more important than we think. We don't know yet. Or maybe some individuals might play bigger roles than others. We don't know. It might be organs, you know, that is organisms that might play the important roles in the global brain. I tend to think that organisms are going to be the most important next unit of evolution on this planet, and then organizations are the next unit of evolution, and then after that we'll get to the global brain itself. So, you know, first we have to make organizations really smart. That's the first step, you know. Before we worry about the entire global brain, let's try to make a company smart. Let's try to make a government smart, you know, or a university smart. Can we innovate there? There's tremendous potential to create mini global brains, if you will, within organizations that just make them smarter. That's much more doable than trying to do it for all of humanity, right? So, you know, take a government agency or take a large corporation, instrument it, add the right technologies, and actually augment everybody's intelligence and start to really experiment and innovate with collective intelligence. And there's work going on. There's a lot of thinking. Even at MIT, there's a Center for Collective Intelligence where they're thinking about these questions. But I actually think there's technological approaches that go beyond groupware, go beyond collaboration, that use machine learning and augmentation to really start to take things to the next level, to help members of organizations become smarter and more effective and more productive, and also to help the organizations as a whole learn more productively and operate more intelligently. That's, I think, the next kind of nearest frontier. After that, you know, then it's systems of organizations, enabling them to be intelligent. That's kind of what gets us then eventually to the whole global brain itself being massively intelligent. You know, and the long-term threshold, as all of this happens, that long-term threshold will be when the individual in all aspects of their life is so connected to one or more of these collective intelligences that they just can't function on their own anymore, and they're so reliant on it. And, you know, people are born into it, and they grow up with that, and they never experience life on their own. Gradually, we will specialize. We will lose the ability over time to function, to think, really, on our own. For example, today, memory. It's an interesting question. What's going to happen to human memory in the next few hundred years? Now that basically you don't have to really remember anything because you can just look it up online, will we actually lose the ability to really remember things as well as we used to? You know, when I traveled in Asia, I studied with monks who memorized texts. They didn't have computers, and for thousands of years, what they've been doing is memorizing. And these guys, they memorize thousands of pages, word for word, and they can repeat it to you anytime you want. That's incredible powers of memory. You know, but if you look at anybody in the West, any college student in the West, they'd have a hard time memorizing even one page. Not thousands of pages. Even one page, even a paragraph would be difficult. So we can sort of see there's a big difference in the memories of people who grew up in oral traditions and people who grew up in information technology societies. Well, you know, as people are born into and grow up and evolve in the video games, you know, world and in the world of the web, you know, they don't have to memorize things. They don't have to remember things. And so gradually, maybe, natural selection will start to not care so much about memory. It won't be so important to survival. And so they will no longer be selected for, and gradually humans will evolve that just don't have very much memory because they don't need it. The memory lives outside. Similar things could happen to other cognitive functions. And that's really the question. To what degree will our intelligence start to be outsourced, if you will? You know, what percentage of our intelligence, our knowledge and our intelligence, will come from outside us in the future? If that increases, then, you know, eventually we become the Borg, or some kind of global brain. And the way in which that happens, to the degree to which our own individual intelligence still matters in that system, that's going to be the big question. You know, what kind of life, what kind of world is it going to be? And some of that, by the way, depends on policy, not just on technology. You know, choices about identity and privacy, choices about freedom of expression. These choices that we're making as societies, as governments, and as technologists, are actually the DNA, if you will, of the future of our species. We may be creating a species which is like a beehive, or we may be creating a species which is more like, you know, a pack of wolves. There's lots of different models, and a lot of this is based on these settings, these sort of preferences for freedom, individuality, communication, identity, privacy. These basic settings make the difference between, you know, what kind of collective society will evolve. And in the end, you know, it's an interesting question because, you know, if we build ourselves into something like a beehive or an ant colony, well, those are very good for certain kinds of tasks. They're really good for foraging and finding food, for example. Okay, that's great. They're good for search, basically. But they're not very good at innovation. They only do one thing, and that's all they ever do. And they never change. They never invent any new ways of doing it. You know, if you want to build for innovation or for evolution, you'd probably want to build a very different kind of society. And there you'd need different settings for these basic variables, these kind of settings for privacy, freedom of expression, individuality, and so forth. Well, you know, the people that are making these decisions for us, there's two groups of people that are making these decisions today. They're technologists. When they write software, they're making these decisions, whether they know it or not. These decisions ultimately could affect millions of people. So something to think carefully about. You know, what philosophy are you building into your software? You know, what beliefs or what DNA for intelligence do you want to make? The second group of people are the people making policy, governments and others. And they're, you know, they're defining rules for privacy and communication and free speech and all of these different policies. Those also, you know, feed back into our technology and affect the kinds of systems we build. So, you know, in a way, what we're talking about here are sort of the forces that are shaping our collective DNA for the future. And I think that, you know, I'm not gonna presume that I know the right answers, but I will say, I think people don't really realize the important long-term implications of some of these decisions for their own societies, for their own governments, their organizations, for the future of our species. So it's something to think about, for sure.
Alex has one sort of final question. I'm going to quote it directly. He says, "I found some amazing accidents. You and I were born in the same year, 1969. Nick Bostrom and I were born the same day, March 10th. It's the call of destiny. I'm thinking that we should build a long-term dialogue between us around both the technology and philosophy of the West and China. Last year, I talked to managerial guru Peter Senge, the concept coroner of organizational learning. Chinese philosophy, especially the philosophy of Taoism and the Book of Change, can make great contribution to world civilization during the second axial time. In a speaking draft, I'm integrating the wholeness and dualistic symbiosis change of Chinese philosophy with the theory of general system, evolution, and quanta transition of Western philosophy. History always replays. About 100 years ago, modern physics owed its achievements to the combination of Chinese and Western ideas. Now that the internet story has happened, I see an integration of Chinese and Western ideas again, evolving this further. What are your thoughts on this?"
Well, I completely agree. I actually think, you know, most of the ideas that I've been talking about today, you can find their roots in Chinese philosophy. You know, Buddhism itself, you know, is really a combination of Indian and Chinese thought. At the time when it emerged, those weren't as distinct, really, as they are today. And so they both come from the same source. So I think a lot of my thinking and my approach, and interestingly, my grandfather's as well, really shaped by Asia and the Asian mind and Asian thinking, and certainly Asian philosophy in general. And, you know, I definitely believe and feel that I'm much closer to the Asian view than I am to the Western view in my own life. That's how I approach things. That's my view of the world. And, you know, I think the West has so much to learn from China and Asia in general. We're a very young civilization here in the West. We don't realize that. Just like a young child, we're very overconfident that we think we know all the answers. Actually, you know, in societies and civilizations that have been around for thousands of years, you know, they probably are looking at us and laughing the way an old person might look at a child and laugh. So I think that, you know, we're doing some new and wonderful things, and we're going to make our own contributions, and we already have, I think, really brought a lot of new ideas to the world that are valuable. That's the value of youth. It innovates. It's creative. But the value of age and wisdom is also equally important. And I think that, I'm sorry about the phone. That's really the balance of, what's going on, with, Western and Eastern civilization. So just to kind of recap that. You know, I think that, you know, China and Chinese philosophy, brings kind of wisdom and history, and for Western approach, United States and Europe and West and sort of emerging Western countries are bringing certain new ideas. And if you combine these, you get something really good. I don't think either one on its own, is gonna be as good as the combination. And so, you know, I do think that history does repeat itself in many ways, and that with the internet, we're certainly seeing that again. You know, as we saw with physics and so forth, as Alex mentioned. You know, I think that the dialogue between the West and China certainly has been going on for some time, and it's happening on many levels and in many dimensions. You know, I think that as we get farther along in the path of developing the global brain as it sort of emerges, I think people will look more and more to Eastern philosophy to sort of understand and navigate the complex kind of new landscape that we end up in.
It's interesting, and I think Alex sort of brought this out, this idea of, do you see it coincidental that, you know, you're sort of born around the same time or the same day? Do you believe in those kinds of coincidences at all? Or?
It's interesting. You know, I was born in 1969, not long before the Apollo landing. And I like to joke that, you know, I waited for that to happen. I wanted to come in around that time. But who knows? I do think these coincidences are interesting. Depends, you know. I think there were a lot of people who were born around the same time, not necessarily on the same day, but in the same generation that all have the same sort of idea sort of driving them. And I don't know where that comes from. Or why we all have that idea. And that's an interesting question, you know. Maybe it comes from the global mind. Who knows?
Or maybe it ties in with, you know, Gladwell talked about sort of the people born in the mid-50s and how they, you know, the Gateses and the Jobs and others who have made contributions. There seems to be these different sort of eras. And
yeah.
Gladwell's book, right? So
yeah, it's possible that, you know, there are waves that focus on different things.
Yeah.
You know, it's nobody really knows. I mean, it's interesting how, for example, all of a sudden, different people in different parts of the world who've never met all start thinking about the same thing. You see this a lot with startups, where you get a bunch of startups that all worked in secret and stealth at the same time, you know, to develop similar ideas. Now, why did that happen? It happens with scientific discoveries, too, where all of a sudden multiple scientists will independently discover the same, you know, radical new thing. Rupert Sheldrake and others have taken that even farther and said there's some kind of a field, there's some effect, you know, and whether or not you believe that, you know, it's an interesting hypothesis. You know, maybe there are sort of ways that ideas are transmitted that we're not aware of yet, you know, that don't require a physical medium. We don't know. We're just only at the beginning, really, of our understanding of consciousness and the mind and what's possible.
You know, 100 years from now, when we reflect back, and, you know, there was this recent IBM Jeopardy challenge, do you think that will be some kind of an inflection point?
I think it was a nice PR stunt. Does it say anything really significant? Does it establish anything of lasting importance? No, I don't think so. I think it will be a point on a timeline. It won't be a major change. I don't think that the IBM Jeopardy challenge, you know, was the birth of any sort of new artificial intelligence. I think it showed, you know, that artificial intelligence can be pretty good at answering trivia questions, which is, you know, I think an interesting data point. But it's not consciousness. It's not that IBM Jeopardy system, you know, still wouldn't be able to go to a fast food place and order a hamburger on its own. So, you know, it's still pretty limited in what it can do.
Okay, well, Nova, I mean, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I know your schedule is very demanding, so we're indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview, and thank you for sharing your considerable wisdom, substantial experience, your historical contributions with our audience.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure, and I really look forward to hearing the interview.
This concludes our exclusive interview with Nova Spivak, celebrated world-renowned, pioneering global technology visionary, innovator, strategist, entrepreneur, and investor.